Welcome to this TED Learning podcast on gender identity, the first in our series of podcasts on lived experiences. I'm delighted to be joined today by Ben Peachey. Ben is non-binary, the author of two books, a freelance writer, a fashion critique, and an LGBTQ plus advocate. And I'm delighted to be joined by them today. Ben, welcome to this podcast. Just take us through what it means for you to identify as non-binary.
It's a really interesting question. And the thing is, I don't get asked personally what it means very often. I'm quite often giving it in the context of work. So I'm explaining what it means for other people. But for me, I like to explain it in a visual way. I think humans love to see things simply. And we think about gender quite often as colour. And we see male as blue and female as a pink. And so a lot of people go, oh, so non-binary is purple. And it's like, no, I'm not one of the Teletubbies, although Tinky Winky is an icon. So no, I'm not this 50-50 purple. And I sometimes then go, okay, so let's think about color. It's a really useful metaphor. And bring up a color wheel. Think of the Photoshop color wheel that blends color beautifully. Gender is that spectrum. It's not linear. It's an amalgamation of whatever I want it to be. And so for me, gender is a blend of all the expressions that make up me as a human, that make up my gender identity. So non-binary is an undefinable state. It's a feeling that I can't quite define or vocalize. It's my gender expression, unique to me, unique to every single non-binary person. There'll be no two of us will be alike. We'll all explain it differently to you. But it's the thing that makes me happy. It's the thing that's given me the freedom in my life. And so I guess what it means to identify as non-binary is to be free from expectations placed on me. Being non-binary is I'm asserting that there are no rules you can place on me because I'm ungovernable when it comes to gender.
And when did you realize that you were non-binary?
Again, another tricky question. It's really interesting, and I'm currently reading Munro Bergdorf's memoir. I can't put my finger on it. I don't know when I realized. There was a sense of discomfort and ill at ease around who I was as a person from my earliest memories. Can I say I knew I was non-binary then? Probably not, because the language didn't exist. I've known my difference all my life. I guess I didn't know what that was or how to put my finger on it. It wasn't until I saw other queer individuals expressing gender in their own unique ways that I was like, ha, that could be that for me. And so I suppose it was my mid-20s when I went to university a little bit later. I didn't go when I was 18 because life scared me. So I didn't go until I was 21. And I guess when I started experiencing queerness outside of rural North and East Yorkshire and, you know, being around London, that's when I was like, okay, this could be somewhere I want to be. And that's when I began having the framework, having the language for it. So I guess in short, for a soundbite, I've always known, but I've not always had the language for it, if that makes sense.
And what sort of challenges did you face when you started to come to terms with that and start to live your life as a non-binary person?
It's interesting you say that. I've just come straight from therapy, so it's a really good time to talk about this. You rapidly get very comfortable with who you are as a person. I think so many of the narratives wrapped around non-binary people and the trans community as a whole is our discomfort, is our failing to come to terms with who we are, which is wrong. That's a fallacy. We know who we are and we're pretty comfortable with that. There can be some wrangling with dysphoria. There can be some wrangling with expectations or internalized phobias we have towards ourselves. But we know and we're pretty comfortable with ourselves. The biggest thing that we have to deal with is other people. You know, the hardest thing about being trans and non-binary is everybody else. You know, I am constantly dealing with other people's thoughts and feelings about me projected to me or on me. You know, I can't walk down the street without somebody having a problem with me or someone having something to say or feeling that they can express their feelings. And that's quite a sedate version of, you know, the worst versions of what can happen to you. And so the challenges are, you are constantly dealing with everyone else's emotions, constantly dealing with, like, in the best sense, it's that people assume that they know who you are as a person because they've met one other non-binary person, or they've read an article, you know, on Vice, and they think they know everything. And so they're placing expectations on you. And a misconception is that, you know, you can categorize non-binary people. Wrong. Like, you can't. There's no way to group us or categorize us. The only reason I think a lot of the queer community uses labels is because society forces us to. You know, that's why, and I know this is completely off topic, but that's why we use cisgender as a word. We use it to help us categorize everyone else who forces us to be into categories. And so hearing it and being told that it's a slur, it's only a slur because people use trans and non-binary as a slur, right? And we're constantly dealing, I think I'm personally dealing with everyone else's feelings and emotions, and it's constant that I feel guilt, or I feel that I'm the elephant in the room, quite literally, that I'm the problem. And I think that's maybe one of the biggest challenges or misconceptions. And, you know, it can get worse. I've dealt with hate crimes. I've dealt with very physical altercations in the street, you know, that have been created because of other people's discomfort around me. You know, that's something that I've dealt with and moved on from. It's constant. Other people's expectations always having to deal with how you make other people feel. And, like, yeah, I don't think we're the problem. Everyone else is.
But how do you deal with that? Because you're just living your life. You're going about your daily life, and you're being subjected to, you know, you just described physical altercations. What drives people to have such anger towards another human being just because they're choosing to live their life perhaps differently to themselves?
The annoying thing is I can really understand it because I write about it, I teach about it, I educate. Difference is scary to human beings. And, you know, as far as we have come, as I do believe that Britain is a beautiful melting pot of difference. Difference is what defines Britain. And I think that's brilliant. A lot of people have grown up in insular communities. They've grown up in families that look like them, with advertising that looks like them, with buying into products that look just like them. And so I represent something vastly different, or something. And sometimes I think, in a selfish way, we hold the mirror up to people, trans and non-binary people. And I know, you know, I've just come from therapy and I've just had this conversation. And therapy is one of the ways I cope. Honestly, it's that self-maintenance. But we hold the mirror up to people because we have taken everything we've been given and gone, I'm not happy with this. I want to change it. I want to explore. I want to really look into who I am as a person. And I've done that. I've done the work and I've changed myself, and I'm evolving, and I'm honoring who I am and who I've always been. And to a lot of people, they've not had that opportunity, or they don't feel like they can break free of the parameters of expected gender, of social norms. And that upsets people. And it's almost this sense of, in knowing who we are and stepping into our freedom and asserting who we are, it holds a mirror up to people of, and makes them feel uncomfortable and makes them feel like maybe they should change. And the way I can vocalize that is, I remember when I was at school and everyone was talking about open days at university, and I was like, I don't really know what you're talking about. I have no idea. And I felt so behind and so uncomfortable. So I went so far in the other way. I was like, well, I'm just not going to go to university. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. And I think that's what people do. They go so far the other way with their discomfort. It comes out as hatred. It comes out as abuse. And knowing why doesn't stop it hurting, but it does help you associate less intention. I can push it aside a little bit easier because it's not personal. It's not about me. It never was about me. It's about the other person in that altercation. It's harder when it's closer to home. It's harder when it's somebody you know. But for people on the street, it never really was about me. It never really was about us. It's always about them.
Because, you know, I've read that sort of mental health challenges, suicide amongst trans and non-binary people is considerably larger than it is affecting maybe other groups. And that must be driven by some of the experiences that you've just talked about, and why it is important for you to have therapy and to be able to talk about it. I was delivering a course just very recently, actually, and it's for a company where, in all my years of delivering training, I've never experienced so many people who identified as non-binary. There were some trans people that worked in this company who were very open and comfortable talking about their lived experiences because the company had really created that culture. But there was one person last week that just said, look, I just don't get it. I don't understand non-binary. How would you answer that question if someone said, look, what does it mean?
It's a really, really hard question. I think, first of all, I would honour the fact that they just don't understand it. You don't have to understand everything in this life. There is so much to know, so much to absorb. To stop and to try and understand it all, quite honestly, I think someone's head would explode. So it's okay not to understand it, and I think that's absolutely fine. And sometimes people do come to spaces like that and they just can't understand, and maybe they don't want to, or maybe they just don't have the headspace. Fine. That doesn't remove you from the contract of respect. That doesn't stop you from being able to acknowledge who I am as a human being and being fine with that. I don't need you to understand me. I need you to respect me. I need to be offered all the privileges you offer all your cisgender colleagues, friends, people in your lives. And I think, you know, taking away that burden of you must understand me actually allows room for people to go, okay, fine, I don't understand it. And because it doesn't affect my life, maybe I don't need to understand it. But it then gives them the space to go, but I do need to respect that person in the same way that I want to be respected. And sometimes I get asked, you know, what does your utopia look like? What's your perfect solution? And I'm quite honest and frank, there is no utopia. That just couldn't, it just couldn't exist. Human is imperfect. It's wrong to think of that. But if I could, you know, make some changes, it would be that everyone has the space to be themselves and to be left alone, to be given the respect to be themselves without having to explain who they are. Because we never ask cisgender people to explain how they know that they're fine and comfortable in their gender identity. We never ask those questions, and to ask those questions back sounds ridiculous, but that's how I highlight quite often. You know, I wouldn't question someone who says they're a woman. I wouldn't go, but why are you a woman? You don't just think you're confused. Is that just a phase? So it's creating the space to just respect each other. And sometimes people just won't understand, and you have to learn when to move on, and it's okay.
So how do you handle if someone does misgender you?
In a personal sense, it's difficult because you never want to make something bigger than it is. And it can be very hard to put your point across without letting somebody else getting upset. Like, I find that so often that people are so quick to be defensive when you correct them. So what I try and do is, if I'm misgendered or the wrong pronouns are used, I will gently correct. I'll repeat the sentence with the right pronoun or the right gender identity in it, and then that's it. And it's my gentle reminder of, this is what I expect you to say to me, this is how I expect you to refer to me. It's imperfect, it doesn't always work, but it's me sort of being like, this is how I would like you to treat me, in a sense. It's something that evolves. It's something that, you know, it's not the most comfortable thing in the world. It's, no one likes that conversation.
Does it feel like a battle that you're facing every day then? Because, you know, human beings are, as you said earlier, used to perhaps dealing with two genders, and suddenly this whole challenge of, you know, that not being the case and it being more fluid and it being wider. And, you know, you might correct somebody on day one, and the following week they make that same mistake or get it wrong again. Does it feel like that?
It is exhausting. I think battle is a really good descriptor. And, you know, some of the, like, I can be quite short with people, and I can be quite, and I don't want to say difficult because I'm not difficult, I'm just hard to take advantage of. And so sometimes in corporate settings, when I get annoying or stupid questions, it's like, just don't say it. Please don't say that. Please don't do that. And people are shocked and surprised. And I'll go on to explain, well, this is the first time you've voiced that. Fine. That's the seventh time this week I've had to deal with this. It is exhausting and it is relentless. And the annoying thing is a lot of the commentary is that people outside of the conversation, so cisgender people, they do find it too much. They are annoyed with it. Oh, aren't we done with this conversation? Why do we need to keep on talking about it? You're tired. Imagine how exhausted we are. And I think that's what's linked to the higher rates of mental health concerns and suicide in my community, is that we are tired and that we are exhausted and that it is relentless. And you either choose to check out the conversation, not be bothered by it and move on, or you choose to check out and leave Earth, right? And it's, I wish there was a less emotional way of saying it. It's too hard. It's too much. And I've realized for me personally, what I do will not benefit me. It never benefits me. I'm benefiting my community, future generations. And I've had to like swallow that my life will probably always be hard and that my existence will always upset people because I'm with a generation of people that are just refusing to change. And so it can be very difficult. And, you know, the way you said it, it does feel like a battle. On the worst day, it does. But there are moments where you feel like you are getting through to people and you are changing. And that's where it feels like the little wins and it feels like the tide is turning. I guess for me to mitigate some of that battle feeling is just removing myself from spaces that make me feel like I'm fighting, to remove myself from people that make me feel like I'm fighting just to be honored for who I am. And so it's, you know, sometimes you just have to leave people behind.
And you've used an expression a couple of times so far in this podcast, the word queer. And that has divided even the gay community, hasn't it? And, you know, again, I was asked very recently, well, that used to be a really offensive word. You know, how's it being used now? What's your response to that?
The youth versus older community member argument over queerness is silly. Like, educate yourself. Like, queer was reclaimed in the 80s by a really amazing group of lesbians and activists. I think it started in Washington, D.C. And so queer is all about reclamation. And so it's totally fine. I do want to stress that it's fine. If you don't like that word, fine, don't use it. But for so many people, and I think why queerness is so important to this generation, but also older generations, it has enough meaning to it to say, this is who I am, without having to go into detail of who you are as a person. Queerness is all encompassing. Queerness is inclusive. It's a brilliant inclusive term that goes, this is enough of a label for you to leave me alone, but also enough of a label for me to still question who I am and grow through that phrase. I love queerness. I totally understand that people don't love it as a phrase, and that's absolutely fine. But it's personal preference. And I think, yeah, I think there's so much power in a word that has been reclaimed. It's been used against me all my life. But to be fair, that makes me love it a little bit more because it's mine and I've taken it back. And I remember when I was a child, like, so I'm going back to like 90s, early noughties. There was a lot of people. It was this phrase, so if you were called gay, you were supposed to like respond with good as you. I don't know if you remember that. Yeah. And I hate that. That makes me feel really uncomfortable. I will never say that. And that's maybe what it is for my generation. And I just think duality, two things can be true at the same time. Some people can not love a word and some people can love it. And I think if we're truly an inclusive and accepting community, let's just be both. Let's have people that don't love it and have people that do. And I think the important part of this conversation, if you are not queer, whether you love the word or not, it's not your job to jump in on that conversation and tell us we shouldn't be using it. I think if you're outside of our community and you are cisgender, heterosexual, you're not in the queer conversation, so don't try and tell us. Inside the community, we can absolutely debate that term, but I don't want to be told by someone else outside of my community, I can't use a word that means so much to me.
And we touched on the workplace. I'd like to just move into that space, if I may. What's been your experience in work? What what have you experienced sort of, you know, doing jobs? What sort of challenges have you faced?
So I'm freelance and have been freelance for a very long time, purely because I'm not employable by corporate situations. My feedback from interviews is that you're too free-spirited, too independent, too creative. And what I have, you know, taken on board and actually evolved with is I'm not moldable. I'm too independent. I'm too much of my own person to be molded into a corporate situation. And so what I've realized is that, you know, difference upsets people even in a work setting. And so it's meant that I've had to forge my own career path, which is so much harder. That being self-employed is really, it's tough. It's really, really tough. And so that's like maybe the first barrier. And then, you know, I mentioned it earlier, even in my freelance world, I've had clients telling me that I'm difficult. And that's something I held on to for a while. And what I actually realized, and I said it earlier, I'm just not easy to take advantage of. I have so many boundaries and things that I will not renege on because I honestly think it's important. And so I've definitely moved on from people quicker, moved out of spaces that don't make me happier. I am definitely more aware of when people are trying to minimize you or reduce you or make you into something you don't want to be. In so many situations, I think, especially, and it's, you know, it should be a positive thing where I'm booked because I'm part of the trans community, because I'm non-binary, but I then see people wanting me to perform a certain way to give them, you know, in corporate settings, I don't want to give personal stories. I don't want to give you me being upset. I want to be here. I'm here to work. You know, I'm here as a professional. I'm here because I'm good at what I do. And so sometimes I see people expecting me to give them rawness. And it's like, if that's what we talked about and discussed, fine. But if we haven't, I don't want to do that. And I think people forget that I'm a professional. They see my identity first. And so that I definitely think is something that is a barrier. And also, you know, it's realizing that certain situations just aren't going to work for you, or you have principles that mean that you don't want to take on a piece of work, or you don't want to work with an organization. And that's a hard thing. You know, it's like thinking about not just myself, but the community, and thinking, you know, if I worked with this business, what harm would it do? How would it affect the wider community? And so I guess that affects me in some ways. I don't know. It's a hard one. It's evolving all the time. I have good months, bad months. I have good years, bad years. Like, I felt like this Pride season we've just come out of, I felt like one of the bigger barriers in these corporate spaces is that people are asking unfiltered questions that I've never had to answer before. Personal, that they're not just rude, they're just inappropriate. And yet people feel like they have the comfort to ask these questions. That's new to me, that space. You know, that's especially when it's like clients on their first step of their journey in the DEI space. And you know that you realize that, oh, we've got a lot more work to do than I realized. But because you're the first practitioner in, you're the one that takes that brunt of the like, wow, let's just stop those questions right now. That's the hardness, I think, sometimes.
It shouldn't be like that for you. You know, there should be organizations. I mean, I think the thing that always interests me and fascinates me is that when Pride Month does come up, you see all the corporates change their logo to, you know, to the flag and say that we're really embracing it. And yet that's your lived experience of going for interviews with some of those companies. So what advice would you give to corporate business to create a more inclusive place for trans and non-binary people?
It's a big question, and probably more than we can handle in one conversation. Quite often I find when I go into businesses, they'll tell me, well, we just don't have queer representation in our business. You know, I'll go into a law firm or an insurance company and they'll go, well, you know, people who work in insurance and lawyers, they're not part of the community. We don't have trans staff. But then I'll go, but you have trans customers. And they'll go, and I'm like, I buy insurance. I have several insurance policies. If, you know, for example, I'm hate crimed in the street, I'm probably going to need a solicitor or a lawyer. you've got trans customers, whether they're in your business or not, they're paying your bills. They are literally putting the lights on for you. We're part of the conversation. And I think people forget, just because we're such a small minority, that they don't need to do the work for us. And that's, you know, something that comes up a lot, is that if we're such a small part of the conversation, such a small part of the population, why do we have to care so much? Why do we have to do so much for this tiny, tiny part of the population? And isn't that raising the conversation around women's rights or rights on racism? And it's like, actually, the more specific we go with our understanding, the better we do for everyone, right? And one of the ways I explain it is, let's try and think about how policies at work could benefit trans people. Do we have a transitioning at work policy? Do we have a policy that allows people to take time away from work to access affirming healthcare, whether that's hormones, surgery, or just adjusting to the world around them? That seems like a really specific policy, but that policy can then be rolled out for anyone who goes through the menopause and needs to take time away to access affirming healthcare, whether that's hormones or surgery, or time away just to adjust the changes that their body are going through. So a really specific policy actually benefits everyone. So one of the ways that businesses can help make an inclusive culture for trans and non-binary people is realizing that actually by looking quite specific at how you are benefiting everyone at work, you're actually helping the wider community and really vocalizing that to your wider staff, of making them understand that this will help everyone. So it's not pandering to the few, it's actually doing better for everyone. And then I think there are other ways. And I think one of the things, and I touched on it earlier, is that they'll say, well, we don't have the staff. Why not? Why haven't you managed to attract a diverse staff? How are you not being able to do that? So thinking about how you are recruiting, are you advertising that you have strong ethical policies? Do you have your responsibility documents available to see from the day one? Is that part of your onboarding? Is your HR team fully inclusive? Are they aware of how to recruit? And if you're seeing this problem coming again and again, you're the problem. It's not us, it's you're the problem. You're not able to bring diversity into your business because you are putting people off, so you won't grow. So it's really about the recruitment, the HR, the retainment process is the one that needs to change. And that's where I'm doing a lot of my training with HR professionals, to try and get them to see how they are holding everyone back. And it's not their fault. The culture of work is their fault. It's the top table. There's no diversity in business. And then I will quite often get the conversation from businesses that, like, but why? Why should it matter? Diverse businesses benefit from cognitive diversity. And cognitive diversity is, in basic terms, will create more profit. It will create more growth. And I hate that I have to say that, but in year one, phase one, the start of that process, you have to offer the golden carrot on the end of that stick. If you do this, your business will do better. And then we'll touch base again in a year and we'll actually implement those changes deeper. We'll deal with some of the systemic issues. But right now it's about realizing that the better you do for everyone, the better everyone does, whether that's economic growth, whether that's business growth, or whether that's just your staff being able to turn up and be themselves and give more of themselves in work, then it's better. And it's about realizing that it's about the onboarding process. It's about training all staff. It's about not singling out trans and non-binary people. Like, I've had so many conversations with people during Pride where the person on the team is an only. And when I say an only, they represent a minority group and they're the only person in that role or in that business. And so when it comes around to Pride, the head office people will come, can you run our Pride events? Why should they? And so when people say, no, there's no Pride events in that business, that's because you're putting it on the wrong people. DEI in businesses should not be volunteer roles alongside your job. It should be a job that you put money towards, that you're paying someone to do. The reason DEI fails in so many businesses is because people are doing 9-to-5s and they just don't have the time. But businesses see that and go, well, it just didn't work. It didn't take on. It didn't take off. It's actually, you need to put money towards it. And that's my answer. Pay. And it will get better.
I mean, I remember working with a client a couple of years ago, and we were doing some DEI training with them, and we were doing the prep for it. And they said, we don't actually have any lesbian or gay employees in our organization. It was 800 people that worked there. And I remember being quite taken aback by it and saying, sorry, how do you know that you don't have any lesbian or gay employees working in your business? Oh, well, we'd be aware, wouldn't we? And I said, well, not necessarily, actually. Only if the culture enables people to be open about themselves and be, you know, their authentic selves at work, would people maybe feel able to come out. And it was watching that reaction on their face there. Well, we just thought that people would tell us if they weren't. It's like, not necessarily. So it's really interesting to sort of hear about, you know, your kind of lived experience from a work perspective and some of the work that you're doing. I'm going to move on to something that quite often when I talk about gender identity and gender reassignment as part of the Equality Act, when we're doing the training, provokes strong reaction. And that's around, how do you navigate sort of gender specific services like toilets and changing rooms? Because this is the bit that I find the press is so obsessed about and so focused on. I'm not going to credit the journalist at all who makes his life out of being, you know, vile towards the trans and non-binary community. And I have another example of that. But how do you handle that situation?
It depends how safe I feel. If I don't feel safe, I don't handle that situation. You know, I'm lucky that I don't spend all day in people's businesses. So if I don't feel safe, I will not interact with those facilities. I will not need to use them, and I will go somewhere I know I feel safe. You know, I really like Pret-a-Manger because their toilets are genderless and they are everywhere. So they're very safe to me. So that's my safety. Even if I don't know the spaces I'm going into, I have somewhere safe for me to go so that I don't have to create problems. It's difficult because I work with different people and I work within different systems. When I'm working in a situation where I've been managed, so my agency has handled some of the logistics, we ask. I have those questions asked for me. My team ask for me ahead of time. So someone either will tell me when I get there, or I'll have had it in an email, or they'll tell me there isn't a specific space for me, but I'm allowed and safe to use, and they will ensure I'm safe in these spaces. Quite often I'll get told at the end of a session when I'm on my own, if I've done it on my own as just a consultant, I'll have done a session and then they'll tell me, oh, you could use this space, or you could, but you quite often I just don't use spaces because you don't know the response or the safety. It's a difficult thing, and it's an important part of the conversation. It's just the boring part of the conversation because we just need to move on. Honestly, it's not the biggest part, and it's where the conversation's getting stuck. This moral panic is ridiculous because let me tell you, a trans person, I can guarantee you 99% is not going to be the one causing problems in those spaces because we don't feel safe in those spaces, right? It's not us causing the problems, I promise you. So just get over your moral panic. And like, honestly, just if a person is in a space and you don't feel that they should be there, that's on you. It's not on them. They know where they need to be. They're in the right place. Let me tell you that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a really considered way of approaching that, I think. So thank you for that. You mentioned earlier in our chat that you don't think your life's ever going to be easy, but you're spending a lot of your time trying to help that next generation come through and make their life a little bit easier, which is something that, you know, underrepresented groups across the protected characteristics of the Equality Act have had to do for generations. What do you see, two parts to this question, as your role in helping that next generation? And for that next generation, what advice would you give to them to help them have perhaps a slightly easier journey than you've had yourself?
Well, I think, first of all, it's understanding where I'm coming from. I and so many of us, we stand on the shoulders of the people that did it before we were even here. So I say that my life's not going to be easier, knowing that my life is easier than the previous generation. It's almost that paying it forward moment. That's why I do what I do. I'm helping because I was helped. And my role, and realistically, and I think I realized it this year, that I can't on my own change the systemic stuff. I cannot fix society. I don't think even as a group we're really able to do that well. I think that's going to take a lot more work. My role is, if there is a future for us, we've got to be there to experience it and enjoy it. My role now to my community is to protect our mental health, to give us actionable, obvious ways of enjoying our lives. So my TED talk, for example, focused on the fact that trans joy is not radical. I want people to stop seeing it as unattainable and realize that actually trans joy exists in every breath we take. It's in every moment of our lives. And if you just start seeing it like that, there's so much more joy in your life. It doesn't take away the absolute clusterfuck that is life. It doesn't take away from the fact that it is hard just to be trans, let alone live. But it does make your life easier. And so that's my role. And so my message to help the next generation is to, and I think it's hard to give a message to the next generation because it's not on them. I think it's to give a message to the people that are taking care of the next generation, of parents, of educators. Give them every opportunity to be open. Don't, like, I think my generation and older, we were closed off. We were told it was wrong. We were not shown it. You know, we grew up through Section 28. We weren't allowed to talk about it. There's, at the minute, no legislation that's doing that, or that what the government's trying to do does scare me. Be open, be as open as possible. And I think be open to experiencing it and just say yes, as opposed to, you know, when, I don't know if you've ever done any improvisation. I know you use drama to explain some of this stuff. Improvisation is yes and. And I think when we're talking about the queer community, we should be saying yes and, instead of no but. Be open, allow yourself to experience everything, and you'll work out who you are. You know, the fact that I am able, as the role model, as an ambassador for the charity Diversity Role Models, the fact that I'm able to speak to young people, that they're just able to see me, is so much more than I had. If I'd have known and had the language and the conversation and the role models at like 12, who knows where I'd be right now? The fact that I've done all my growth and development in the last 7 years is ridiculous, you know? So say yes and just experience everything. That would be my message to the next generation.
And you see the role model now. I mean, we have a trans non-binary person playing football. I mean, that in itself has provoked some reaction from certain elements of the press. But that's the sort of role model that younger people need to see, isn't it? To say, you know, this is what my life could be like. It's not without opportunity.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm currently in a place where I'm booked because I'm trans and non-binary, because that's who I am. I would like us to get to a space where that stuff doesn't matter so much. We're booked because we're talented individuals. I want to start see trans people in all roles because they're good at those roles, not because they're trans, right? Like, why have our marginalizations become the hyper focus? Like, whenever there's a new high court judge in America and it's amazing because it's a Black woman, and that is lovely and that is brilliant. But didn't she get the job because she was talented? Isn't she an exceptional judge? Isn't that the thing we should be focusing on? I would like us to be seen more than our difference. I don't want to be singled out because I want to be included because I'm good at what I do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, completely, completely. Ben, it's been such a genuine pleasure to speak to you, to hear about your lived experience, and to, you know, listen to some of the advice that you've got. I wish you so much love and luck in your journey ahead. I know that we're, you know, at TED Learning looking forward to working with you and adding you as a consultant to our team to help us become a more inclusive business and the clients that we work with. But thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us on this podcast today about your lived experience.
Thank you for having me.
For more of our podcasts, visit our website at podcast.tedlearning.co.uk, or you can find us on most podcast platforms.